Hi there, we are James and Dan, two fourths of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Each week we get around the microphones with our four favourite facts that we've learned over the last 7 days and sit down to blow each other's minds.
Yeah, here's a fact for you, Dan.
Yep.
In knot theory, a circle of rope without a knot is technically a knot, but it's called a knot.
Very good. I got one here as well. In 2019, a marathon runner with the words Jesus Saves written on his bib had a heart attack, but was revived by a man called Jesus.
That is amazing. If you want to hear more facts like that, search for No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts.
Light out. Everybody.
What's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Lights Out. I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm the producer, Daniel.
Today, we're going to be taking a look at one of the most haunted locations in all of England. It's known as the Witch's Cage. This is a house that was a jail many, many years ago in the small little village of St. Osyth. And this place is haunted unlike anything I've ever seen before. And it makes a lot of sense. I mean, if you think back to the witch trials here in the U.S., I know we've talked about some haunted locations associated with that. And just what some of these women went through was unbelievable. I mean, the cruelty, the suffering that they endured was just insane. All because somebody came and said, I think she's a witch. I think she bewitched or cursed my child. And people just took that as face value. And before they knew it, they were being burned at the stake. And in the case of the UK, they didn't burn witches at the stake. They hung them instead. And in addition to a very, very dark history, the cage also has a terrifying family haunting associated with it as well. But Danny, have you ever met or known anybody who's been a self-proclaimed witch before?
Yeah, I have.
How were they?
Very kind.
Yeah?
Yeah.
They weren't devil-worshipping psychopaths?
No, I mean, I guess she classifies herself as a Wiccan, not a witch. So
okay.
I wouldn't know if I would classify her as like a traditional witch, but because she identifies more as a Wiccan. But she's, honestly, she's one of my wife's best friends. Great person, great personality, always been nice to me.
Same. I've had nothing but very nice interactions with people that call themselves a witch. There's a really cool kind of metaphysical witchy store down in Manitou Springs in Colorado. And the woman that owns that is a witch, and she's always been super, super friendly and really knowledgeable about all things, whether it be witchy things to the metaphysical to even some of the more taboo subjects. But I always find them super interesting, and it's been sort of a goal of mine to get a really legitimate practicing witch here on the show who's got a lot of experience. Sort of in that realm to kind of educate me further. So if anybody out there is a practicing witch who has some very interesting stories to share, hit me up because I'd love to interview you and learn more about what it means to be a witch. But back in the day, back in the 1500s, this was a totally different time period where there was zero understanding or desire to really understand what it meant to be a witch. And it could have just been somebody who is like a holistic health practitioner who was, you know, creating tinctures and using herbs and other supplies to try to heal the sick. And that in itself was considered demonic and resulted in their death a lot of the time. And just a wild time to be alive. I mean, anytime I see a film from this time period, I'm always just shocked and bewildered at how insane it must have been to and the fear that many women lived in, trying to, you know, practice these things that were very innocent and harmless in nature, and yet, you know, somebody comes along and they have a disagreement on beliefs with you, then before you know it, you could be cast into the cage where you would sit and wait and often be tormented waiting for your fate to be decided. I mean, it's just a whole other level of brutalness. But what if I told you that one of the most terrifying medieval witch prisons in England still stands today, and some say that the spirits of the accused have never left? In this small village of St. Osyth sits an ordinary building that the locals call the Cage. But behind its simple walls lies a chilling history. In the late 1500s, it was a jail that held women accused of witchcraft during the village's brutal witch trials. They were locked away, waiting to face interrogation, harsh judgment, and a grim fate. Some say the suffering that filled that house over 400 years ago never faded away. And over the centuries, stories surrounding the Cage have only grown darker. And what makes it even more unsettling is that the old jail was eventually renovated into a home, with people living within the same walls that once imprisoned suspected witches. Visitors have reported hearing noises when no one is present and seeing apparitions appear before their eyes. Some people have even experienced being physically attacked by an unseen presence. Because of many accounts like this, the Cage is considered one of the most haunted locations in the United Kingdom. Was this small, old jail simply a place with a dark history, or did the pain, fear, and injustice of the witch trials leave something chilling behind? To understand the Cage, we need to understand St. Osyth. The small village is located in the county of Essex and has an estimated permanent population of 4,600 people. Though it's a small place, St. Osyth is steeped in history and legend. For instance, the town's name comes from Osgith, a 7th century noblewoman and nun, and legend has it that in 700 AD, Osgith was confronted by a Viking pirate off the coast of Essex. The pirate demanded that she denounce her faith in God, but when she refused, he beheaded her. It's said that she was guided by angels to pick up her own head and walk back to her nunnery. Once she entered, Osgith collapsed to the ground and died. Her courage and faith earned her canonization from the Catholic Church, and her story was passed down through the centuries and left a chilling mark on the village that bears her name. And this story is just one of many in St. Osyth's sordid past. The most infamous historical event in the village occurred in 1582 when St. Osyth became the center of a deadly witch hunt. The story of St. Osyth witch trial centers on one woman, Ursula Kemp. Ursula, also known as Ursley, was well respected in the village as a healer using holistic and spiritual practices to treat the sick. However, historians have noted she was also a poor, single mother who earned some money as a nursemaid and midwife. Ursula was also considered to be a quote-unquote cunning woman. During the Middle Ages in the United Kingdom, cunning folk were considered practitioners of good magic by using charms, spells, herbs, or grimoires. People would turn to the cunning folk to cure ailments, bring fortunes, or even lift witch curses. Even though witchcraft was deeply feared in the late 1500s, people in the village saw Ursula as someone who used her abilities to help others. But that reputation would shift when Ursula's neighbor, Grace Thurlow, came to her seeking help. You see, Grace had a young son, Davy, who became dangerously sick. But once Ursula used her abilities to treat Davy, he recovered fully. During the entire ordeal, Ursula and Grace formed a friendship. However, their relationship unraveled in late 1581 when Grace was preparing to give birth to her second child. Ursula wanted to work as her nursemaid during the delivery, but Grace never asked her for help, and Ursula felt slighted by that. After the birth, she confronted Grace about it, and their friendship completely fell apart. And shortly after this, Grace was stricken with a bout of lameness. According to the Society for the Study of Disability in the Middle Ages, lame was used as an adjective similar to impaired or weak and often referred to an issue with limbs. The exact details of Grace's bout of lameness are unknown, but we do know that she did seek Ursula's help in curing it. Grace told her she couldn't afford the 12 shillings for the treatment, but promised to pay once she was healed. Ursula agreed, treated her, and shortly after that, Grace was healed. However, when Ursula later came to collect her payment, Grace refused to hand it over, which deeply angered her. A few days later, Grace's newborn daughter suffered a horrific accident. The baby fell from her cot and broke her neck, which caused her untimely death. But Grace didn't see this as an accident at all. She believed that Ursula put a curse on her family, which had stricken her with lameness and caused her baby's death. Grace had some influence with important members of the village since she worked in the home of Magistrate Brian Darcy. Using that connection, she leveled accusations against Ursula. And according to the historical pamphlet on the trials, on February 19, 1582, Grace went to him and formally accused Ursula Kemp of witchcraft. Soon after, another villager, Agnes Leatherdale, came forward with more accusations against Ursula. She claimed Ursula had whispered a spell into her daughter's ear, and afterwards the girl became very ill. And with these accusations and her reputation as a cunning woman, Ursula was arrested and thrown into the village jail that would later be known as the Cage. Before the Cage became infamous for imprisoning witches, it was just the village's lockup for petty offenders. It was a cramped one-room stone structure, and the only thing in the cold place were sets of iron chains on the wall to detain the criminals. The space was always in darkness, except for when the jailer would open the heavy iron locked door and sunlight would pour in. As harsh as the jail was, the Cage took on a darker reputation after Ursula Kemp was held there. During her confinement, Ursula was questioned by Brian Darcy. In the official records, there's no written account of any torture inflicted on her, but historians have questioned if that was purposefully omitted. Based on methods used during other witch hunts, it's not difficult to assume that cruel torment was inflicted on the accused in St. Osyth. And we'll never know exactly what Ursula endured. What we do know is that she ultimately confessed to being a witch. And this was an incredibly serious admission. At the time, witchcraft was widely feared throughout England. In 1563, Elizabeth I passed an act against conjurations, enchantments, and witchcraft making, witchcraft punishable by death. In 1579, just 3 years before the St. Osyth witch trials began, Elizabeth I assembled a group of magistrates and justices of the peace to reprimand them for not doing enough to prosecute witches. So by the time Ursula was imprisoned, local officials were eager to pursue witchcraft cases as aggressively as possible, likely as a way to make a name for themselves and advance their political careers. Magistrate Brian Darcy also questioned Ursula's 8-year-old son Thomas, and he admitted to Darcy that his mother was in fact a witch. He also told him that she had 4 familiars, 2 cats named Jack and Tiffin, a black toad named Piggin, and a white lamb named Titty. Thomas also claimed to have witnessed all of them drink blood from his mother's arms. After Ursula was imprisoned, her son was abandoned and his fate is unknown, which is just extremely cruel that there was no care for her child whatsoever. During Ursula's next round of interrogations at the Cage, Brian Darcy offered Ursula clemency in exchange for a full confession. And she confirmed everything Thomas had said was true and even elaborated further. She claimed her familiars were also used to cause bouts of lameness, harm farmers' cattle, and inflict pain on people. She even said she sent her cat Jack to torture her own sister-in-law after her sister-in-law called Ursula a witch and a whore. Worst of all, she confessed to commanding her white lamb to kill Grace Thurlow's infant daughter. After this massive confession, Brian Darcy brought Grace Thurlow and Agnes Leatherdale to the Cage to confront her with their accusations. Ursula fell to her knees and begged for their forgiveness, but her pleas were ignored and she was left to rot in the Cage. The next time Brian Darcy returned to question her, Ursula began accusing other women of witchcraft, most likely in a desperate attempt to free herself. The first woman Ursula accused was Alice Newman, who she claimed had used spells and spirits to torture children. She claimed that Alice Newman also assisted in killing Grace Thurlow's baby, and Ursula also named Elizabeth Bennet and Alice Hunt as witches. When Alice Hunt was questioned, she confessed and also said that her own sister, Marjorie Salmon, was also a witch. Some of the specific details about their imprisonments have been lost to time, but many believe that all 5 women were being held in a single room inside of the Cage. And from there, the witch hunt descended into chaos. Among the 5 accused women, they named 9 others, including Cicely Sellis, Elizabeth Eustace, Agnes Glasscock, Margaret Greville, Annis Hurd, Alice Banfield, Joan Petchy, and Swallow, and Joan Turner, and they were all jailed for witchcraft. This led villagers to come forward with claims of witnessing the women performing said witchcraft. Some said the women had even placed hexes on them. A local shoemaker accused Agnes Glasscock of murdering his child through spells. Joan Petchy's neighbor said they often saw her talking to herself. A man accused Cicely Sellis of burning down his barn with magic after he refused to sell her malt. All of these stories were harmful for the accused women, but the most dangerous accusation was made against Elizabeth Bennet. William Bonner, a local man, came to Brian Darcy and claimed that Elizabeth Bennet was having an affair with his wife. Elizabeth denied this, along with any claims that she was a witch, but by then, she was no longer trusted by village authorities, and she remained detained in the cage. Ultimately, it was too late for the women to save themselves, and all were tried for being witches. Despite her confession, Ursula received no leniency. Both she and Alice Newman were charged with murder by witchcraft for killing Grace's baby. Alice was sentenced to remain in jail, and Ursula was to be hanged. Elizabeth Bennet was found guilty of murder by witchcraft and bewitching William Bonner and his wife. She was also sentenced to hang alongside Ursula. The exact date of their executions is unknown, but it's believed to have been sometime in late March, just over a month after the witch hunt began. It's believed that the two were buried in unmarked graves. The fate of all the other women is unclear. Some appear to have been released without going to trial, but most died in jail. Even those found not guilty were kept inside of the cage, unless they paid for their own release. This appears to be the case with Cicely Sellis, who was found not guilty of burning down the barn, but records show she remained jailed afterward. By the end of the St. Osyth witch hunt, 14 people were tried and 2 were executed. In the decades that followed, witch hunts became common across the surrounding area. Between 1644 and 1647, the infamous witch hunter Matthew Hopkins was responsible for the execution of about 300 people throughout Essex. Eventually, in 1736, laws against witchcraft in England were repealed, and the hysteria finally came to an end. If you've watched any sort of TV or media these days, or just really just been on the internet, you've probably run across an ad for GLP-1s, and maybe it's something that has sparked your interest. Maybe you've been somebody who's had health issues. Maybe you've been somebody who's, no matter what you do, it's a real struggle to lose weight. You've never been able to hit your goals, and you're looking for an alternative. You know, maybe you're scared of needles. Maybe you're just, the whole thing just seems way too much. Then you need to hear about Roe. Roe offers the first FDA-approved GLP-1 pill for weight loss at the lowest cost around. Yes, it is in pill form now. The GLP-1 pill has the same weight loss ingredient as a shot and packs comparable results to the shot. It can help patients lose 14% of their body weight in a year. On average, that's one daily pill for fewer cravings and feeling fuller with an innovative new formula, clinically proven to maximize weight loss. The new FDA-approved GLP-1 pill is available at $149 for the first dose in addition to your Roe membership fee and $299 a month for the higher doses. Roe is there to help you through the entire process. They simplify it so that you can understand exactly what you're paying for. Everything is run through a doctor. But the nice thing about it is it's all online, so you don't have to go anywhere. You don't have to go in to see anybody. But the Roe Body membership includes access to FDA-approved GLP-1s, unlimited provider messaging, side effect management, and more. All just $45 for your first month and $145 a month thereafter. The Roe membership fee excludes the cost of the GLP-1 medication, but in addition to the newly approved pill, Roe also has a full suite of most effective brand name FDA-approved GLP-1s, all at the lowest cost. Roe offers the lowest cost GLP-1s whether you're using insurance or paying cash. So you can also run it through your insurance and or just check to see if your insurance will cover it as well before you go through the whole process. After your online visit, if you're eligible for treatment, you can expect to start your medication in less than a week if paying cash or about 2 weeks if using insurance. And they just ship it right to your front door, which is super convenient. You can go to ro.co/lightsout to see if you're eligible for the new GLP-1 pill on Ro. That's ro.co/lightsout to get started on Ro. Go to ro.co/safety for box warning and full safety information about GLP-1 medications. One piece of clothing that many of us overlook and just kind of often cheap out on is underwear. I mean, something you wear every single day, you wear it all day long. You want to make sure you're wearing the world's most comfortable underwear. MeUndies. I've actually been using MeUndies for a long time. I have a number of pairs from years ago, and I still have them, I still wear them, and they have lasted 5 years, which you cannot say about a lot of other underwear brands, but not with the MeUndies. They're still as comfortable as they were 5 years ago. My wife absolutely loves the feel-free bralettes and undies that are made from the ultra-soft modal fabric that moves with you. There's no adjusting, no irritation, just comfort that lasts all day long. They have styles for everyone, whether you like prints, whether you like black basics, or just basic colors. Plus, they come in sizes extra small to 4XL, guaranteeing a flattering cut for every body. I absolutely love them, and I know you will not regret buying a pair of MeUndies. And right now, as a listener of my show, you can get 20% off your first order, plus free shipping at MeUndies.com/lightsout. And use promo code LightsOut. That's 20% off, plus free shipping at MeUndies.com/lightsout. Use promo code LightsOut. And through all of this, the cage continued to be a fixture in St. Osyth. For centuries, it held men, women, and children for crimes, and at one point, it even served as an isolation building where the sickest villagers were kept away from others. Darkness also surrounded the building. The small roadway beside it was called Coffin Alley because it was the route the coroner used to transport bodies to the local cemetery. By 1908, the cage was no longer used to detain people, though the exact reason is unclear. Even so, the structure still stood. Locals began to believe that spirits roamed the building and even wondered whether the town itself was cursed. That speculation grew even stronger in 1920. A local man, Charles Booker, was digging for sand at his property on Mill Street when he unearthed two skeletons. Because the remains were lying in a north-south position, Charles believed that the two skeletons belonged to that of Ursula Kemp and Elizabeth Bennett. He built a fence around the burial sites and charged people to come view them, even printing and selling postcards with photos of the skeletons. Shortly after starting this grim business venture, Charles's cottage burned to the ground. Many locals blamed the witch's souls for cursing Charles. However, his grandson Paul later told a local paper he believed his grandfather accidentally started the fire after knocking over an oil lamp while drinking. Either way, the skeletons were reburied for 30 years, only to later be excavated and sold to the Boscastle Museum of Witches. Eventually, one of Britain's top osteoarchaeologists examined one of the skeletons and determined that they most likely belonged to a 25-year-old male and not Ursula Kemp. Despite this, myths of witchcraft and curses remain strong in St. Osyth, especially around the place where the accused women suffered the most, the cage. In 1970, the cage underwent major reconstruction. The single room was connected to the building next to it, and a second story was added. The infamous jail was transformed into a two-bedroom home with a kitchen, dining room, living room, and doorway leading to a second floor. In the decades that followed, the home became a revolving door of residence, with no one staying longer than 4 years. But that all changed in 2004 when Vanessa Mitchell moved into the home. Now, Vanessa had grown up in St. Osyth, but had moved away when she was a young adult. She wanted to move back to her hometown, and while there for a visit, she came across a for sale sign on the cage. She had walked past the structure countless times when she lived in St. Osyth, but had never thought much about the old building. But now something was different. She was absolutely drawn to it. She needed to own the home. She didn't even think about looking at another place because the cage was calling to her. She later said, "It was calling me. It needed me. It wanted me. I just had to be the owner." Here's a clip of Vanessa in a later interview where Vanessa explains why she bought the house, even though there were rumors of it being haunted.
So why did you go ahead and buy it when you knew all
that? Because I loved it. It's a beautiful little cottage, and it's got the old prison door, and it's a little slice of English history. And
I mean,
it's stunning.
You said it was your dream home, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it was. It's pretty, and it's all the history involved in it. And I loved it. I really wanted it.
So it didn't put you off? You weren't spooked knowing?
You didn't have a bad feeling?
I thought it would be haunted, but I had quite an idea, because all the local villagers said that it was. I thought there was a chance, but I didn't think it was as bad as it was.
So how bad was it?
Well, on a typical day, you'd be sitting there, things would fly across the room, door latches would go up and down the stairs, taps turning all the
time. Ruth would be gone, now she'd have packed her cases and be living
with
her mum.
She
would be gone, she'd be gone.
It was bad, it was very active.
Vanessa learned that the last owner had hanged himself in the home, but that didn't deter her from wanting it. because within weeks of seeing it, Vanessa bought the home for £144,000, and by February 2004, she moved into the home with her friend Nicole. And right away, the two felt an intense energy as soon as they started moving in. Nicole said, "It felt heavy. It's like walking in jelly." And it didn't take long for frightening things to start happening. On move-in day, Vanessa was standing in the kitchen looking out the window at the infamous Coffin Alley when she heard footsteps approaching. She turned around expecting to see Nicole, but she was frozen in fear when she saw what was really behind her. A massive shadowy figure stood in the doorway. It had a human-like shape. It didn't have a visible face, but Vanessa could feel it staring at her. Then it slowly faded away right before her very eyes. Vanessa was terrified. She didn't want to scare Nicole, so she kept it to herself. But soon the activity became too strong to ignore. A few days later, Vanessa returned home from work and walked into the kitchen. And on the counter was a pristine piece of paper. There was no crease or tear, almost as if it were just printed. When she slowly picked it up, she realized with a sinking feeling that it was the death certificate of the last owner, the man who had hanged himself in the house she was now standing in. When Nicole got home, Vanessa asked her if she had placed the death certificate in the kitchen, but Nicole only stared at it, confused, and said she had never seen it before. Years later, Vanessa spoke with the widow of the previous owner, and she told her there had only ever been one copy of the death certificate, and it had never left her possession. Strange occurrences only grew more frequent after that. Objects would disappear without a trace, only to turn up in odd places neither of them remembered putting them. The sinks would turn on when no one was around them, water running as if unseen hands had turned the handles. Doors would slowly creak open and slam shut with intense force, even though no one had stepped into the room. The tea kettle would start boiling on the stove when neither of them had touched it. The fireplace brushes and pokers swayed against the chimney with no wind to move them. And sometimes the TV would blast to full volume, and CD players would turn on by themselves playing music neither had chosen. Soon the haunting began to take a physical form. One day, Vanessa walked into the living room and froze when she saw that every single electrical item had somehow switched on at the same time. And as she nervously began to turn the lights off, a low growl instantly echoed through the room. She turned around, her heart racing, but there was nothing there with her. A few days later, Nicole was sitting alone in the living room when she noticed the rug shifting as if something was crawling underneath it. She cautiously lifted the corner of it and found a thick infestation of maggots twisting and writhing over one another. One night, the two were sitting in the living room watching TV when Vanessa glanced at the ceiling. Hovering above her were hundreds of tiny lights floating silently in the air. She stared at them, absolutely mesmerized and unable to look away. More lights began to appear, multiplying until they covered the entire room. Her eyes stayed fixated on them as she quietly asked Nicole if she could see them. Nicole was already staring up at them, just as entranced. The lights felt strangely warm, almost comforting. It was one of the very few times they felt at ease with an unexplained presence in their room. There was another time when Vanessa believed she encountered a spirit that meant her no harm. One afternoon, as she sat alone in the living room, a woman silently walked in as if she had always been there. She carried a small bowl filled with herbs as she slowly approached Vanessa. The woman's presence felt kind and gentle, and Vanessa felt no fear as the figure came closer. When the woman stopped directly in front of her, she sprinkled the herbs over Vanessa's head and then slowly faded away. Vanessa could never be certain who the woman was, but she often wondered if it was Ursula Kemp. She felt that whoever it was, that they had come to shield her from the sinister forces that seemed to linger throughout the house. But after this brief, unearthly visit, the house seemed to be taken over by a malevolent sense of dread, and the things that followed were far more intense. In October of 2004, Vanessa and Nicole decided to throw a Halloween party. Vanessa was upstairs when she heard loud footsteps stomping down the stairs, followed by the front door slamming hard enough to rattle the walls. She stepped out of her room to see if Nicole had left, but she was still in her bedroom and had heard the sounds too. The two of them walked downstairs together, but the house was empty and the front door was still locked from the inside. Scared but trying to calm herself down, Vanessa returned upstairs and went into the bathroom to get ready for the party. As she looked in the mirror, a large shadowy figure unexpectedly appeared behind her reflection, and it was the same dark form she had seen the first day she moved into the house. Paralyzed with terror, she couldn't bring herself to turn around to see if it was truly standing there. After what felt like a lifetime, the figure dissolved and disappeared like it had never been there at all. After this, Vanessa began confiding in her friends and family about the strange things happening in the house. At first, most of them brushed it off, believing that her mind was just playing tricks on her. But that changed when some of them had frightening experiences in the house that they couldn't explain. One day, Vanessa's friend Mickey came over to help fix a light. He had always been skeptical of Vanessa's stories and didn't believe there was anything in the house worth fearing. He was standing at the top of the stairs fixing the light when he felt a pressure on his shoulders and a cold feeling washed over him. Before he could process anything, an unseen force pulled him violently down the stairs. After that, he wasn't so sure that Vanessa had been imagining things, and he began to believe there were malevolent spirits inside of the house. A few weeks later, Vanessa had her friend and their husband over. The three of them were drinking tea and chatting in the living room when the husband went still, staring down the short hallway that led to the front door. His eyes were fixed there for a few minutes before he asked Vanessa why there was so much blood on her floor. The three of them stood up and walked towards the hallway to look. Vanessa's friend, who was familiar with the look of blood from her work as a nurse, knelt down to examine the dark liquid stains. She was absolutely certain that the floor was covered with blood splatter. It didn't make any sense. Vanessa had only let them into the home a few minutes earlier, and the floor had been perfectly clean when they walked in. Even if they somehow missed it, there were no footprints or smears anywhere, so none of them had stepped in the dark liquid, which almost seemed impossible. They wondered if an injured animal had somehow gotten inside, but every window was shut and none of them had heard anything, smelled anything, or seen anything before the husband pointed it out. The blood had simply appeared where nothing had been moments before. No matter how hard they tried, they couldn't figure out a rational explanation for how it could have gotten there. And these were far from the only unnerving experiences visitors had at the house. One time, Vanessa's cousin was standing in the kitchen when she felt soft, deliberate taps on the back of her head, and an icy dread spread through her whole body. When she turned around, no one was there, but containers of sugar that had been on the counter were now sitting on the floor, as if someone had neatly placed them there. Another eerie event occurred when Vanessa's friend Jackie was over. She opened the door at the bottom of the stairs and froze. A man in brown clothes caked in dirt was standing at the top of the stairs. Jackie bravely made her way up the stairs as the man quietly watched her. She reached the top and walked right through him in order to get to the bathroom, and when she turned around, the man was gone. A few days later, Jackie was at the home again. She was standing outside next to Coffin Alley when she looked into the kitchen window. Inside, she saw an entire funeral procession of pale figures walking through the house. One by one, the ghosts passed through the kitchen's walls, making their way to Coffin Alley. After all these unexplained events, friends stopped wanting to come to the house. But one person wasn't worried. Nicole had been seeing her boyfriend for a few months when he decided to move in. And at first, he was a total skeptic and didn't really believe all the stories that Nicole and Vanessa had told him. But not long after he arrived, he was home alone one day when they had an experience that left him shaken to the core. He was upstairs in his and Nicole's bedroom when he heard heavy footsteps climbing up the stairs. The closed door began to shake and the latch rattled violently. It abruptly stopped and everything fell into a suffocating silence. The latch slowly lifted and the door creaked open. But of course, no one was there. Shortly after that, Nicole became pregnant. She and her boyfriend felt that the house was no place to raise a child and decided to move out. Vanessa was left completely alone in a house that completely terrified her. One thing we talk about a lot on this show is how easy it is for strangers to get their hands on your personal information online. There are literally thousands of companies collecting, aggregating, and selling your data. Things like your full name, phone number, home address, relatives, employment history, and more, often without you even realizing it. And that kind of information floating around the internet can lead to some very real problems. I've actually dealt with this personally. A while back, someone managed to locate my personal information from a data broker, most likely, and they went ahead and filed a tax return on my behalf, which was completely fraudulent, trying to claim that they were me in order to get a big, tasty tax refund. And luckily, the IRS caught the return before it was processed. But this really scared me, to be honest with you. I had no idea how easy it was for somebody to get a hold of my exposed data, and that's why Incogni is so important to cleaning up your personal information on all of those data brokers out there. When criminals can find details about you online, they can do things like open credit accounts in your name, craft convincing phishing scams, or even attempt tax fraud like what happened to me. And we see stories like this constantly now, with massive data breaches exposing millions of people's personal information, or people discovering that their home address and family details are listed on random people search websites. But that's where Incogni comes in, because Incogni helps remove your personal data from the internet by contacting data brokers and websites that collect and sell your information and requesting that they delete it on your behalf. Instead of spending months or years tracking down all these sites yourself, Incogni handles the requests automatically and keeps you updated on progress. One feature I really like is their custom removals option on the Unlimited and Family Unlimited plans. If you find your information on a specific people search site or any random website, you can point it out, and one of Incogni's privacy agents will take care of the removal for you. It's basically a way to actively take your personal data off the market, which is something that's becoming more important every year. So if you want to protect your privacy and reduce the chances of scammers finding your personal info, check them out. Go to incogni.com/lightsout and use the code lightsout to get 60% off an annual plan. Again, that's incogni.com/lightsout and use code lightsout for 60% off. Incogni helps wipe your personal data from the internet because scammers can't target information they can't find. Thanks to Incogni for sponsoring today's episode. Everything in the world continues to go up in price, and one of those things is your wireless bill. And with the big wireless carriers, they're always looking for ways to add more to the bill. Maybe you're somebody who wants to save money and use it elsewhere. Well, if that's you and you still want great wireless coverage and you want to still be able to use your phone and phone number, then Mint Mobile may be for you. Stop overpaying for wireless just because that's how it's always been. Mint exists purely to fix that. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with premium wireless plans starting at just $15 a month. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can bring your own phone and phone number, activate with an eSIM in minutes, and start saving immediately. But best of all, there's no long-term commitments or contracts, no hassle. You can ditch overpriced wireless and get 3 months of premium wireless service from Mint Mobile for just $15 a month. Our Higher Hope coordinator actually has a Mint Mobile phone for work, and she says been nothing but great, hasn't had any issues with coverage, and it was an extremely easy process to get that phone set up. We were able to bring over a phone we already had and get that eSIM, and it was just a breeze. Super easy, plus you save a ton of money. You're going to love it. So if you like your money, Mint Mobile is for you. Shop plans at mintmobile.com/lightsout. That's mintmobile.com/lightsout. Upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, 5 GB plan required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customer offer for first 3 months only, then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See Mint Mobile for details. Everything became more menacing once she was left by herself. She would dread coming home from work every day. She felt isolated, terrified to face whatever was happening in the house with no one there to help her. And the spirits may have been feeding off of her energy because things in the home only intensified. She began to see towering black masses lingering in each room and stretching from floor to ceiling. She would hear the sounds of children playing and giggling throughout the house, but no one was there. And in the middle of the day, she would see the ghosts of men and women wandering through rooms. Everything escalated when the spirits began to make physical contact with her. One morning, Vanessa was brushing her teeth in the bathroom when out of nowhere she felt a sharp, violent smack on her back. The pain was so intense that she screamed, spraying toothpaste all over the mirror. Her heart raced as she spun around, but the room was empty, as if what had hit her was never there at all. During all of this, Vanessa considered leaving, but she felt trapped. She had put every penny into the house and still had a mortgage she had to pay for. Plus, even after all the dark, harsh energy that seeped into every corner, she just couldn't bring herself to let go of a place she still loved. But as terrifying as all this was for her, the situation was about to become far worse. Vanessa became very sick and didn't know what was happening to her. And when she went to the doctor and ran some tests, she discovered that she was 4 months pregnant. She was shocked and afraid, but determined to raise her child as a single mother. Now, not only did she have to endure the house's malevolent presence, but she had to protect her child from whatever malicious forces were around her. And the threat was very real. One day, Vanessa was at the top of the stairs when something violently shoved her. She crashed onto the floor of the guest room, but the stairs were just a few feet away. And if the force had pushed her any harder, she would have fallen straight down the stairs. Vanessa would later say that her pregnancy was an incredibly difficult time. She lived in constant fear and was completely isolated after her friends and family stopped coming over. Her mental health began to spiral when she started hearing a voice whisper in her ear over and over again, urging her to take her own life. But no matter how relentless the voice became, Vanessa never gave in. And in December 2007, she gave birth to her son, Jesse. However, what should have been a joyful time was overshadowed by the spirits that surrounded them in the house. When she brought Jesse home, the two of them mostly stayed in her bedroom like it was the only safe place left in the house. She stopped going into the kitchen and would keep pre-made meals in her room. She was too afraid to go to the bathroom, so she kept a portable toilet near her bed. And whenever she had to leave the room, Jesse always came with her. Sometimes he would randomly start screaming or crying while staring into an empty corner as if someone was standing there. Vanessa felt that he was terrified of something evil in the house that she just couldn't see, and the threats towards Jesse became too strong to ignore. One time she left Jesse in his crib in her room for just a few minutes, and when she returned, a basket holding some of his items had vanished. She searched the house until she found it sitting outside the back door. She knew she hadn't moved it, and there had been no one else there that day. After that, whatever was around Jesse didn't bother hiding anymore. Vanessa and Jesse had been hiding in the bedroom for days, and one afternoon she needed to iron some shirts, but her ironing board was downstairs in the living room. Jesse was sleeping so peacefully in his crib that she didn't want to wake him, and telling herself that it would only take a few minutes, she stepped out of the room and left him alone. Everything seemed normal for the first few minutes of ironing until she heard a strange noise behind her. When she looked down, four of Jesse's train toys were rolling across the living room floor towards her. She tried not to look at them and focus on finishing the ironing fast, but the trains kept moving until they circled around her feet, and she could no longer ignore them. She grabbed her shirt and ran to the stairs to get Jesse. When Vanessa reached the bottom of the stairs, she stopped cold. The ghost of a man was standing at the top of the stairs, looking at her. Before she could move, he turned, stepped into the bedroom, and slammed the door behind them. A second later, Jesse's cries erupted on the other side. Vanessa ran up the stairs and threw herself at the door, but it wouldn't open. The sounds of Jesse's screams echoed through the house as she fought with the handle. The door finally burst open and the ghost was gone. She grabbed Jesse from the crib, and in that moment she knew they couldn't stay in the house any longer. She bolted out of the door with Jesse in her arms. The instant they stepped outside, his crying stopped. And after 3 years of living in the cage, Vanessa swore she would never spend another night there again. She and Jesse stayed with friends and family before eventually finding an apartment in town. But the cage wasn't finished with them yet. Vanessa put the home on the market, but no one bought it. She found a few tenants, but none of them stayed for more than a few months. And as the years passed, Vanessa's life became calmer and a little more conventional. She met someone, fell in love, got married, and welcomed a second child. All the while, she continued paying the mortgage each month on the empty house she believed was haunted. Let's take a look at a clip of Vanessa talking about what it was like to still own the cage after she left.
I kind of feel like that now.
Yeah.
And I've still got the cage and I love it, but it became, I had to leave with my son. I was a single parent. I've been paying the mortgage for an empty property now for years. You know, people say, why did you leave? There's a very good reason why a normal female with a son and a good job leaves, moves miles and miles away and leaves a house empty. Why would you do it unless you were terrified? And
that's there is one big problem about you coming clean about all of this. Mm. How are you going to sell
Who's
the place?
It,
Who's going to buy it now?
Eamon, I've tried. I had it up for sale. I didn't even get one person looking. Some, I had a couple of people renting it. They didn't last longer than 3 months.
And so what are you doing? How are you paying the mortgage?
Well, I'm not. Well, my job. Yeah. I've been skint for years.
You're actually now opening the doors for other people to come around and have a look and see if they can feel and see what you felt
and saw. Yeah, that's it. You know, I kind of think, after years of owning it, I don't want to sound corny, but the cage wants to talk. I think if they didn't want to be known in there, they wouldn't be so active.
I think there's a legend element to this as well, with Vanessa's initial experiences and then different groups going in and investigating it. Their experiences are building
Vanessa, I've got 5 seconds. Your experiences, this left you shaken, frightened, what? Mm. How scared are you?
I'm not scared now, but when I left, I was terrified and I had to leave.
In 2016, 9 years after leaving the cage, Vanessa put the house back on the market for £290,000. She told the BBC that she refused to sell it to anyone with children and also said, "It's so haunted, I don't know what more I can do. And it's time for someone to own it who can do more with it than me." But she couldn't find that person, and the house just remained vacant. 2 years later, in 2018, Vanessa decided to open the home to paranormal investigators and enthusiasts. She partnered with a company to sell tickets for people to come spend the night for just £50. That same year, the legend of the cage went viral after the release of a chilling video. Paranormal investigator Brad Mack and his team were conducting an overnight investigation there. Around 3 a.m., they're in the main bedroom, standing silently around a table as their EMF devices began going off. That's when an investigator, publicly identified only as Debbie, experienced something disturbing. Her face was completely contorted. Her eyes darkened and widened, her nose grew out into a point. Her mouth went into a massive grin. Her fingers strangely grew longer. The investigators claimed they were stunned by what they were seeing and managed to capture it on camera. Brad Mack later wrote on his website, The Ghost Hunt UK, "She was unrecognizable, and what I saw shook me to a core. After a moment that seemed a lifetime, I knew I had to film this. I whipped out my iPhone, fully charged, thank God. Her nose, it has changed shape completely, almost like it's a witch's with a sharp arch in the bridge on her nose. That nose is not a prop." And here's a clip of Debbie's face changing.
"What the fuck? Your face has completely changed. Doesn't even look like a person."
"Right, Debbie, you need to come down here for a minute, please."
"Oh, weird, man. Eyes are black."
So it's a 14-second clip, and it's hard to tell how much her face really changes because I'd have to see a picture of her outside of this video. But I mean, she's got a pointy nose, but did it actually change before her eyes? Can we watch it one more time? Oh, I see. Okay. If we slow it down. Oh yeah. What the hell? It's like almost like the eyeshadow around her eyes gets really black and blotchy there. I don't know if I'd necessarily see her nose growing, but her nose is definitely, oh yeah, interesting. Yeah, she's kind of just wearing this like hoodie with a white coat, and you can kind of see over the course of this little clip, her eyes get real black, and her nose kind of gets pointier than before.
Interesting. Yeah.
But again, it's not like 4K quality, but yeah.
And it's extremely low light too.
Yeah, that too. So it could just be how the light's falling on her face.
And if you look at the woman on the right, her eyes kind of do the same thing. And she kind of looks like she has that same smile kind of thing going on.
Yeah, it kind of looks like could be part of the angle too that they're filming at. It's definitely makes her look creepy though, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
But they said that it changed. It contorted. It looked completely different. And then her face returns to normal. Like that first shot looks kind of wild, like the grin.
Like,
yeah, that looks very.
It looks like evil. A thumbnail for like a YouTube horror.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
It looks creepy. I'll give them that.
Yeah, like that shot right there looks pretty interesting.
Right there.
Yeah, but it's the only face we're seeing in this shot too, other than the girl to the right of her.
Yeah, and we can't see enough of the guy's face to really even.
But yeah, from this angle and this light, definitely looks. Looks creepy for sure.
Yeah.
You've definitely heard me talk about Hungry Root before, whether on this show or my other podcast. I love Hungry Root. I really am a huge fan. It's a service that my family loves, that we pay for now because we love it that much. It just makes mealtime so easy, especially with one toddler and now another child on the way. We just don't have time to do all the grocery shopping, all the meal planning that we were able to do before kids. And so Hungry Root just makes it so much simpler. And honestly, it saves us a ton of money because, you know, the grocery store is real expensive these days. So why waste the time and pay all the extra money when you can just do it all on Hungry Root? Unlike other food delivery companies, Hungry Root now has over 50,000 chef-crafted recipes to choose from each week, with many ready in just 15 minutes or less. And they have over 1,000 grocery items like smoothies, sweets, kid snacks, and salad kits, ready-to-eat meals and supplements. So you can do all of your grocery shopping, get all those sort of one-off items from Hunger Root as well. Hunger Root holds all of its food to high standards. It screens out over 200 additives, including high fructose corn syrup, artificial sweeteners, and preservatives. They source only high quality meat and seafood with no hormones or antibiotics. They offer organic produce and non-GMO options and carry trusted brands like Oatly, Vital Farms, Ithaca Hummus, Harmless Harvest, and so many more. So you're going to love Hunger Root as much as I do. For a limited time, you get 40% off your first box, plus get a free item in every box for life. Go to hungerroot.com/lightsout and use code lightsout. That's hungerroot.com/lightsout, code lightsout, to get 40% off your first box and a free item of your choice for life. But after this took place, Debbie quickly left the room and then went downstairs where she felt intense burning on her back. She then pulled her sweater off to find four long marks that looked like fingers and one big burn running along her neck and upper back. Obviously, people questioned the story's validity, while others believe it was a sign of the witch's curse. And no matter what the truth was, there was renewed attention back on St. Osyth in the cage. Because shortly after the incident with Debbie, Vanessa invited renowned spiritual healer and psychic Reverend Ted Woodruff over to the house to perform a cleansing ritual. Whatever he did seemed to make a huge difference. Vanessa said that the home was still haunted, but not nearly as bad. For the first time in nearly a decade, she felt comfortable being there alone. She also still felt deeply attached to the home, once saying this in an interview. "I believe I was supposed to own the house for a reason. I'm not sure what, but I've still got the cage and it still plays a part in my life." In 2019, she actually sat down inside the cage for an interview with the YouTube channel. Shout out The Paranormal Files, big fan here. During it, she said that she loved the house, but it brought her too much turmoil and she was ready to sell, but she believed that the house would choose its next owner just as it had chosen her back in 2004. And it seemed that the cage found someone in 2020, because Vanessa sold it for £220,000, 13 years after fleeing the home. And not much is known about this buyer, but it's clear they didn't want to keep it, because in 2024, it was back on the market for £250,000. And the real estate listing described the home as steeped in medieval history. This former prison for witches dates back to the 16th century and boasts character features. With its quaint charm, the property represents an enticing opportunity for a cozy and eccentric holiday let, offering promising returns on investment. The house was finally sold in March of 2025 to Amy Wayne, who runs the paranormal YouTube channel, Amy's Crypt. Amy and her partner, Jared Cutting, gave an interview to Yahoo Lifestyle about their purchase, and during it, Amy said Jared met Vanessa to gauge her story, and she said she would never live there again. She said the house was cursed and everyone in the village has a story. The postman told us he'd seen someone in the window a couple of months ago, but the place was unoccupied then. Some locals think we are crazy to buy it. The two of them have said that the house is in a state of disrepair, having been basically abandoned for a decade. Their plan is to restore the cage to its former historical glory. Coincidentally, or perhaps not, the same month that the cage was bought by Amy, a bench was installed in St. Osyth as a memorial for the women who lost their lives during the witch hunt. It's part of the Tendring Witch Heritage Trail, which is a walking path that runs through four districts. The purpose is to honor the area's history and folklore while also commemorating the families affected by the witch trials in Essex. But that's where the story of the cage stands today. And whether you believe the hauntings are real, exaggerated, or just myths that have been passed down over time, we can't deny the true horror that once went on there. Because again, people were accused, they were imprisoned, and ultimately executed for things they probably never did. Or even if they did, they were trying to help people. For some, the cage was their decrepit last stop on a torturous journey. And today, some people view it as just an old building in a quiet village. You know, there ain't no ghosts there, it's just an old building. But many people do believe that the cage is a place is never let the past truly leave. I mean, such an old historical building. It's kind of hard for us here in the U.S. to really wrap our heads around just how old, you know?
Yeah.
We can't really visit anything. There's certainly not anything in our state
No.
that's that old, right? like buildings like from 1500s.
No, I guess the closest thing would be like the mesas.
Yeah, but those are indigenous.
Yeah. It's not.
Yeah.
They've been abandoned for a long time and they're more historical sites. Right. Something like this that's been had constant use throughout
the
years.
Right. It's this for some reason reminds me of the melting pot over in Littleton. Is an old jail.
Oh yeah, it is.
And they claim it's haunted. Every time I go there, they're always like asking. I always ask about it because people have claimed to see all sorts of weird things there too. Great restaurant too, by the way. Very good. But it to me, it makes sense, right? The more history there is, right, especially dark history, yeah, the greater chances of there being some type of unexplained phenomenon or paranormal activity existing.
Yeah.
It just seems like, you know, if you believe in the paranormal, right? If you don't believe in the paranormal, then maybe you chalk this up to, this is somebody who purchased this property with preconceived notions that this is haunted, and therefore, you know, by way of placebo effect or something, is having these experiences that aren't really there, but right, they're kind of creating them in their mind because they believe it's haunted.
Right.
Is that kind of what you think?
Yeah, that's kind of on along the lines of what I think. I'll be honest. The video that we saw about the woman's change in the face, that kind of, it landed the wrong way with me. Regardless of how you feel about this whole building, that video just kind of leads me to believe that those specific paranormal investigators were trying to craft something, because he mentioned specifically that his phone was at full battery when he took that video, but nobody took a picture of her back. The physical evidence. Somebody took a picture of the physical evidence that was on her, but they took a video of the video recording. There's lapses of, I'll say, judgment of trying to collect evidence that I see that just leads me to distrust
most paranormal investigators
and these ones in this case too. That being said, a building like this with such a robust, dark
past
and history. I've said this before, it is a place that would be haunted. Like, if there was going to be a place that was going to be haunted, it would be this. I don't think it'd be the melting pot over in Littleton, but I think this would be much more of a realistic place to be haunted. I would love to visit it. Kind of along the lines of what you said, if it's one of those things where if you believe, you'll experience it. As someone who is not a believer, I would love to go and see what I experience. I'm sure there would be many times where the hair would stand up on the back of my neck, just knowing the things that existed here. I don't know. It's a hard line for me to walk, but I do think that video was kind of some bullshit, if I'm just being honest.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard when it comes to supposed paranormal investigators. And
yeah,
when you go out to shoot something, nobody wants to go and shoot a whole bunch of nothing.
Exactly.
So, as many of us know, things are faked or hoaxed or staged.
Exaggerated.
Yeah. Like, and here's the thing too, is like, it's in my mind, there's levels to the paranormal. And I think level one, the most common, right? Strange noises, things fall off. Cause like, I think level one, most of us have experienced that. And maybe we haven't directly linked it to the paranormal, but, you know, I think strange sounds and, you know, maybe even like thinking you're seeing a shadowy figure or something like that. I can see that as being totally plausible in this case, right?
Yeah.
And just from being somebody who's experienced that before personally, I think that's very plausible. It's when people start saying I've been scratched and or like pushed downstairs, or, you know, when things get physically violent in the paranormal, that's when I start really, you know, questioning it more, because that's crazy, right?
How that
part of the phenomenon hasn't been as well documented either. And so it's hard to say what that is, if there is something metaphysical that's affecting, you know, the physical reality of things. That's a whole other question. But and that's we see this time and time again with paranormal stories, is that you have the dark history.
Mm-hmm.
You have loads of suffering, loads of women who are being potentially tortured or just kept in really horrible conditions, dying.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about it from that perspective, I think that being such a place of suffering, you know, that to me, that makes sense why there might be some residual negative energy left over and potentially women died there or people died in this place. I think that to me could lend to explaining some of the paranormal activity. But then you have some more profound phenomena going on, like blood being all over the floor and just kind of randomly being there. And, you know, these more sort of sensationalized details to these stories without any evidence whatsoever, right? If you had something insane like that or something stationary, static, like a bunch of blood on the floor,
yeah,
why not take that as evidence and document it and right, test it? And like, that's insane. If any of us just walked out of our living room and into the hallway and there's just blood all over the floor,
my instinct would not be to just immediately start cleaning it up. I would, first of all, probably call the police.
Yeah.
If there was like, just a pool of blood with happened? No source. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just, there's such a lack of just basic science going on. Of just not even like collecting evidence. There's just a lack of collecting evidence and doing these proper procedures. Like, again, I go back to the woman with the scratches on her back. If I were in that position and I had gotten scratches on my back and a weird burn formed on my back as well, I would go to a doctor at the very minimum.
Because, especially if you're truly burned.
Yeah.
On it, like, out of nowhere.
I'd be like, I would go to a doctor and there would have to be a medical record of it to some degree, which would then at least provide some tangible evidence. But there's not evidence. There's a video of a video.
Also in the video, she's got a hoodie protecting her neck.
Yeah.
And a big coat protecting her back. So if it truly something went through your clothing and inflicted physical harm to you, that would be crazy evidence to collect.
It would be like there's, for as much physical evidence as they are providing, they're not providing any evidence of the evidence. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, bold claims, you know, require bold evidence.
Exactly.
And, you know, as fun as it is to believe things got as insane as they did, I think there, it's also the underlying thing here is that I think she may have purchased this house as a business opportunity. And also, if you, you know, people know there's a market for haunted houses.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can hype up and embellish the story and have this crazy sort of experience within this house, then that only adds value to, you know, a prospective buyer who wants to get a haunted house, right? Mm-hmm. It's kind of the same way with like the Perrin house and the you know, they're haunting and, you know, that house sold for a bunch. And,
yeah, and I mean, the house sold right after she did the interview with the Paranormal Files.
Yeah.
It sold the next year.
Right. So one could say there was benefit to embellishing the story.
Hmm.
It's difficult, right? It's like, I think it also just depends on where you land when it comes to the paranormal and how much are you willing to believe without evidence?
Yeah.
It really comes down to it. Like, how much are you willing to believe something is real without tangible physical evidence to look at? And that's tough for people because everybody lands in a different spot.
Yeah.
I think based on my own personal experience and looking at a bunch of different locations and knowing the history of this place, I think a lot of the paranormal activity reported is legitimate. And I believe there is something paranormal going on here. Is it the souls of these people that died there? I don't know. But is it somehow a manifestation of pain and suffering that occurred in this location for hundreds of years? And it's interesting to me that it's also even withstood all of this time that has happened, has gone on for, you know, this is hundreds of years has stayed there. And then somebody came along and was like, oh, let's convert it to a house.
Yeah.
Full well knowing most likely the history of it. And so it's interesting to me that it just wasn't torn down. But again, I think in a lot of places in England, especially, they don't like to tear. It's not like here, yeah, where they're tearing down old homes every day and putting new stuff up.
Well, I think part of it too is that this, it would be, it's such an old house, it could be considered as a historical site.
Right. Like, it's surprising it's not just like a historical protected site or a landmark or something. That's kind of interesting to me that they allowed it to go private.
Yeah.
And now it's in private ownership.
Do you think it has something to do with the lack of land to build new homes in England, in comparison to the U.S. at least?
There's a lot of open space there too.
There is.
So I don't know what it is. I'm curious if somebody from this area, from Essex, has any insight on this, because it is very interesting that, A, why didn't they make it a historical landmark or a museum or some type of public sort of historical site that is just visited and protected, as opposed to converting it to a private home? I'm really curious if anybody has any insight on that, because it seems like out of all the places this would be, this has got it. And I mean, the town's fully embracing the history there. They have the bench out there now. It's interesting. I wonder what happened there, because it kind of seems like that's probably the route it should have gone, so that everybody can enjoy it versus somebody trying to, you know, monetize it.
Or just live in it.
Or just fucking live in it with all the shit going on. So yeah, I think it is haunted. Do I think everything that Vanessa said happened? No, not necessarily. I think she has a valid reason to try to embellish her story and try to make it crazier than it actually was, because yeah, somebody's going to eat that shit up. You know, somebody's going to be like, that's insane. I want to come live there or buy this place.
Especially if you were sitting on the house for 10 years and living in it.
I mean, it is interesting though, that there are quite a few people that have witnessed some of the events that happened there.
Yeah,
there was a lot of witnesses. So whenever there's a lot of witnesses to a paranormal location like this, it definitely helps with credibility and I think increases my belief in it. But at the same time, it's hard to pinpoint those, drill down to those eyewitnesses and drill down to what their testimonies are, because oftentimes, as in this case, it's reported by somebody else.
Yeah.
And so got to take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
At the end of the day,
it's not even a secondhand encounter. It's like a third, fourth. I don't know.
But it's also just, it's a witch's prison.
Yeah.
It's also kind of continuing on this idea that, you know, a bunch of practicing witches, spooky. It's like this, you know, stereotype that witches are all like spooky or somehow evil. And I'm not a huge fan of that, because I know witches are not that. They're, you know, I'm sure there's witches out there that maybe, you know, do dark magic and, you know, different, you know, spells like that. But the majority are peaceful, loving, you know, earth loving individuals that just, you know, want to be one with nature. Yeah. And it has really nothing to do with, you know, what they were victimized for years and years ago of like conjuring up the devil and demons and all this stuff. Cause that's kind of the nature of the stories. It kind of leans into this sort of demonic sort of storyline, which I think is convenient considering all things, and also with the paranormal investigators being scratched, like that's typically attributed to like a demonic attack or something like
that. Always demons.
It's always demons. We all have them.
Matt Rife purchased this house.
Yeah. Go get it. Add it to your collection. But honestly, it's a really cool location that if I ever find myself in St. Osyth, I'll definitely be checking it out, because 100%. Yeah, I got to get back to England. I only did a little London trip, and I know it's
too much to see in London.
Yeah, and it's just like I went and saw Jack the Ripper, went to the Jack the Ripper Museum, went and did, you know, went to Whitechapel and all that, and saw all that, which was cool.
That is cool.
Just kind of see the history with that, but I need to get outside of the big city and go to the, you know, smaller villages.
History.
Yeah.
I went as a child and I saw the Tower of London, which I thought was really cool. And I was really intrigued by the ghost stories there. But as a kid, you know, I was most excited to go see the huge Lego store.
Yeah, right.
As an adult, I would love to go back and, you know, go to the more rural communities and see the history and the day-to-day life, you know.
Totally. Yeah. Well, let us know your thoughts. On some of the questions that we asked, like, what do you think of Vanessa's story? Do you believe it entirely? Do you think there's questions there that remain? I'm curious, does anybody know why the witch's cage was not made into a historical landmark. I really want to know that. But yeah, thanks for hanging out with us today. Appreciate you. If you enjoyed this episode of Lights Out, make sure you're following or subscribe wherever you're listening or watching. We really appreciate it. We put a lot of hard work into these episodes every week. And yeah, we'll be back next week with another one. But until then, lights out, everybody.
Hi there, we are James and Dan Twofort of the hit UK podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Each week we get around the microphones with our four favourite facts that we've learned over the last 7 days and sit down to blow each other's minds.
Yeah, here's a fact for you, Dan.
Yep.
In knot theory, a circle of rope without a knot is technically a knot, but it's called a knot knot.
Very good. I go on here as well. In 2019, a marathon runner with the words Jesus Saves written on his bib had a heart attack, but was revived by a man called Jesus.
That is amazing. If you want to hear more facts like that, search for No Such Thing as a Fish wherever you get your podcasts.